Okay, so the four Brahma Viharas are the four states that I talked about briefly earlier and said I would talk about more. Brahma means supreme or celestial. One translation I heard of it that I liked, is, as I've often said, is the word best. Vihara means dwelling or abiding or home. So taken together, these four qualities are said to form our best home. And like any home, we may not be there all the time. Certainly we leave. But it should be the place where we feel most authentic, most at ease, least pretentious. We're home. So the first of these qualities is loving kindness. The word in Pali language of the original Buddhist text is metta, M-E-T-T-A. And it does, is most commonly translated as loving kindness. More literally, it means friendship. And so sometimes I think of it now, I'm playing in my mind with the word kinship, you know. It's just a sense of connection. It's like the lady in the elevator and I, or, you know, the dog and I, for that matter, the dog in the sweater. Or just a kind of recognition in the exercise that we did yesterday, where I asked everybody to just spend a few moments, we can do it again right now, and reflect on all the beings who are somehow involved in your coming to sit in this room right now. You know, because none of us just arrived here like poof. It's a confluence of interactions and connections and relationships that have led us to be here together right now. Everybody who gave you a book or told you about their meditation practice, or, you know, so many layers. So this moment in time for any one of us is also connected to many beings, not all of whom we like or liked. But the connection is there. You know, so it's a certain view or vision of life. That's how I really think of metta, not so much as an emotion or a feeling, but it's like a sensibility. Like we're all in this together. This is how it actually is. And out of that sensibility, there's a certain responsiveness, like, I can't just get ahead and leave you in the gutter, you know? It's not going to work that way. That's not how life is. That we just respond to one another. I don't have to look at you as though your life has nothing to do with me. I don't have to look at you and discard you in some way. So it's a knowing of connection. Doesn't mean we like everybody. It doesn't mean we approve of everybody. It certainly doesn't mean we invite everyone to move in. But we acknowledge deeply that there's a kind of connection. It's like the Dalai Lama saying, I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. So imagine what that would be like. Because really, frankly, how do we tend to meet people? Sometimes we're so lost in self-preoccupation. It's like the story of me. You know, we hardly even notice them. It's like, what do they think of me? You know, do they like me? How much do they like me? Do they like me more than they've ever liked anyone they've ever seen before? Oh no, I said something really off. They hate me. You know, but who are they, actually? Do we even notice? Sometimes not. So that tendency towards self-preoccupation, which is very different than loving oneself, or is often mistaken for it, but is very, very different, makes our world very narrow. And so we have a strong sense of self and other and us and them. And we miss so much in that. So they say the Buddha taught loving kindness meditation as the antidote to fear. Fear being one of the great ways we cut off and get absolutely lost in a sense of self and other and us and them. And loving kindness being energetically very different. It's like, okay. It's almost like taking an interest in beings resonating with that sense of connection. So it's friendship. And again, it doesn't mean we like everybody. We don't even like all of our friends, do we? You know? I was just talking to a little boy, the son of a friend of mine, and for some reason he was telling me about this friend of his who he said, he's really kind of obnoxious, but somehow he's my friend. And I said, yeah, I get that. I really understand that. Now, so one of the difficulties people fall into with loving kindness is that idea that we're going to like everybody and it's all going to be so sweet and gooey and sentimental. It's really not that at all. It's just that acknowledgement, like we're in this together. There's a connection. There's a bigger picture of life of which we're all a part. So the as these qualities are talked about, they're also talked about as having what are, in the Buddhist psychology, what's called a near and a far enemy. The far enemy is the complete opposite of the state, of the Brahma-Vihara state. The near enemy is something that's close enough so that we could confuse it, but essentially it's very, very different. It's just, on a superficial glance, it seems very similar. And unless we go deeper, we will confuse them. So the far enemy of loving kindness is aversion, which is anger and fear, which in the Buddhist psychology, those two states are the same. Anger and fear, they're just two different forms. Anger being the expressive, energized, outflowing form, fear being the held in, frozen, imploding form of wanting to strike out against what's happening, declare it to be untrue. So loving kindness is like the complete opposite of anger and fear, and that dynamic. The near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. It's close, but it's really very different. So attachment in this specific sense doesn't mean like bonding, you know, or the ways we might perhaps use the word in the West. It really means holding on. It implies a level of trying to be in control. So attachment, or one of my friends once called metta, or loving kindness with an edge, would be like, may you be happy by next week, you know, in the following 15 ways. Or, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. Very conditional, very rigid, brittle, and obviously subject to great disappointment and frustration and breaking apart. I mean, if we say I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake, well, how long is that likely to last? You know, that's not that long. And so attachment can be confused with loving kindness, and we do that all the time, but they're really very different. It's not to say, you know, it's not to say attachment is a state to be condemned, but we can see how it causes suffering. It's so clear when we look. It's like the Buddha saying, one who holds on to that which must inevitably change is like someone holding on tightly to a revolving wheel. At some point or another in the cycle, you are bound to get run over. You know, so holding on is a particular relationship. It's not about connection. It's not about bonding. It's not about caring. It's not about intimacy. It's about holding on. And so part of the exploration we make as we look at these qualities is what is loving kindness and what is attachment? And we spend enough time in both, really, to be able to articulate, even if not in words, but certainly for ourselves to know the difference. So that's one way of understanding that quality. Compassion is, of course, very connected, but it's also distinguished in some ways from loving kindness. It's defined as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's a movement of the heart. It depends on seeing pain as pain, because that's what will have our hearts tremble. So if we're looking at our own situation, for example, and we see our own fear and greed and anger and hatred, if we don't call those things bad and wrong and terrible and miserable, but we call them painful, which they are, we see them as states of suffering, then we will have a different response. Rather than contempt and shame and anger and fear toward our own mind states, we will feel that sense of compassion, that quivering of the heart. And there's like a tenderness there. And so too, when we look at others, when we can discern, when we can see pain as pain, then there's like a movement of the heart in response. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty. It's having such a distinct sense of otherness for someone that we don't resonate with the pain that we are causing or that they're in. If someone is like an object, we don't have empathy. We don't have that sense of, ooh, that must really hurt. And that's considered the source of cruelty. You can do anything to someone when it doesn't count, right? When it has no meaning, it has no consequence, no effect, because we're so cut off, you know, that we don't recognize them. So that's the far enemy of compassion, is that kind of cruelty. And the near enemy is a really fascinating state. The near enemy of compassion is classically translated as sorrow or grief. It doesn't mean grief in the Western psychological sense of grief or sorrow. It means being overcome by suffering. We recognize the suffering, so it's not that kind of callousness or cruelty, but we're so like inundated with it, you know, and overcome by it, that we're depleted, we're exhausted, we're burnt out. And so there's no way in that state of exhaustion we can actually respond, we can actually come forward. And in some ironic way, in that state, our own discomfort, our own dis-ease, our own exhaustion often takes center stage, not the other person's situation. It's like we feel so bad that that becomes all-consuming. And so it's kind of a funny consequence, because we have even less to give or be present with someone else with. Someone once suggested, he was a good translator too, he suggested that the word despair would be a good translation for it. So maybe that that's the word. We know the state anyway, whatever we call it, where it's just too much. And we lose heart, we lose energy, we're exhausted. And the consequence of that, of course, is that we withdraw, we pull away, we look the other way, we start to deny. All the ways we could be deepening compassion are thwarted or undercut. So even though it's close to compassion and it's easy to confuse the two, it's really, it's a very damaging state, both for ourselves and for our efforts. And so this is also a fascinating edge to be working with and looking at. You know, when do we feel compassion? When are we just kind of shattered by the suffering that we see? And I went to Walter Reed Army Hospital not too long ago, a year and a half ago, I think, something like that, because it was National or International Nurses Week. And they were bringing in all kinds of people to do programs for the nurses. And I have a friend who's a nurse there. And So she brought me in to teach meditation for the nurses, and she arranged for this tour of one of the wards for me before I started teaching, and of course it was like excruciating, you know, and very difficult and painful to be there and see all those young people and their families, and you know, it was very hard. And at the end of the tour, she turned to me and she said, you know, the nurses who can stay here, and of course by stay here that means continue to serve here and contribute and try to make a difference. So she said, the nurses who can stay here are not the ones who get lost in sorrow. She said, the nurses who can stay here are the ones who can connect to the resilience of the human spirit. And I thought, that's it right there, you know, and beautifully put in a perfect kind of situation to explore that in. When we get lost in sorrow, we can't stay. We can't keep trying to be present. We need to connect to something that's resilient, that's uplifting, that's opening, that's bigger. And that is part of the exploration of what compassion is. It's not just feeling bad. Otherwise, we'll feel really bad, you know, in very quickly, and we're not going to be able to do anything. You know, so that's a crucial part for each of us, you know, even personally, as well as in terms of our understanding. It's a crucial part of our exploration.